From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the writer Francisco Cantu is joining us to talk about his experience as a Border Patrol agent. He studied the history and politics of the border in college, but he wanted to see what it was like on the ground. Part Anglo, part Mexican, Cantu often felt the tension between those two cultures as he tracked fellow humans through the desert. He'll join us to talk about what happens on both sides of the line. We'll be right back.
KUER's community calendar is a resource where you can find hundreds of events happening across Utah. You can learn a new skill in workshops, experience art and performances offered across the state, scout family-friendly events and activities, and a whole lot more. You can also share your own events. Just fill out the form. It's all on our website, KUER.org. Just click Community Calendar under the Events tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Francisco Cantu must have felt conflicted about being a Border Patrol agent. He's partly Anglo, but his mother is the daughter of a Mexican immigrant, and she raised him in the Southwest, not far from the fences and walls that are supposed to keep migrants from getting in. But he had a fascination about borders. He had studied border policy and border history at college, and he was tired of reading about it in the books. He wanted a real, tangible experience. In his book, The Line Becomes a River, Cantu writes about joining the patrol, working there for 4 years, where he encountered real people. And he says when he joined, he wasn't sure if working on the border would help him understand himself or the tension between the cultures he carried inside him. But he figured he would never understand unless he got close. Francisco Cantu is a writer and a translator. His essays have appeared on This American Life and Harper's N Plus One. He was in Utah recently, and he joined us in the studio. Francisco, I wanted to begin, actually, with there's this story you tell in the prologue, and I kind of wanted to begin there because I found it was interesting. So it's the story that you tell about going to West Texas, to that border, you know, between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. And then there's this moment where you cross over, and your mom twists her ankle in the middle of this busy intersection in this street, and people there are incredibly kind, and you end the story with this shop owner who says, "Aquí están en su casa." You know, this is your home. Why did you begin there, do you think?
You know, I think the principal reason is that, you know, I wanted from the very beginning to complicate the sort of black and white, you know, one-dimensional way that we are usually presented with thinking about the border. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're talking about the border, you know, in the dominant narratives in this country, it's usually being presented as like a place of violence or hostility or danger. And, you know, for me, the experience of being in Ciudad Juarez that has this, you know, mythology of violence and murder and death hovering over it, I think it's also really important to start from a place that acknowledges, like, the essential human decency and normalcy of that place as and so I think also, you know, being told by someone there, you know, as a foreigner, mm-hmm. You know, even though I speak Spanish and, you know, even though like my mother and I look like we maybe could fit in, but not quite.
Yeah.
You know, to be told, you know, like you are at home here, like you are welcome here, which is really the opposite, the exact opposite that people are being presented with just on the other side mm-hmm. of that border. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, people are being told you are not welcome here. Don't come here.
You write about this conversation you have with your mother, and she's wondering, you have informed her, you're in the process of becoming a border agent. And she's just mystified by it in some ways. I mean, she's like, you've got this degree. Why do you want to become, you know, a border cop, as she says? You went to college. There's all these other things that you could do. And what you say to her in the book is that you wanted to see the realities of the border day in and day out. You said, I don't see any better way to truly understand the place. When did you come to that idea, and what is it that you were trying to say to her? Because she didn't understand, at least not then.
Yeah, and of course, I'm pretty doubtful that I would make the same decision now, or that if things had gone differently, if I had studied somewhere else, that I would have made the same decision. But I think, you know, the decision to me as I was making it was sort of based on the fact that, you know, I had grown up in Arizona. I had grown up sort of like at arm's length from the border and at arm's length from, you know, sort of like my own heritage as somebody with, you know, immigrant ancestry and Mexican-American background. But I grew up in a very small white cowboy town. And you know, my experience was I went away to college on the East Coast in Washington, D.C., you know, with this idea of like broadening my horizons and, you know, studying international relations, mm-hmm. wanted to like travel the world. And kind of as a reaction to what I was encountering, you know, in that environment, surrounded by all these ambitious young people who, you know, were really like showing off everything that they know in the classroom. My reaction to that was to turn back toward where I had come from. Mm-hmm. And even though I was so far away from home at that point, to really invest more in understanding the place where I was come from, because I wanted to be able to have some skin in the game when I was talking about these issues in class. And so, you know, I studied abroad in Mexico. I took, you know, every class I could about U.S.-Mexico relations and North American trade. And you know, by the end of that, it still felt removed from the cultural realities, right? Like the realities of the landscape. Mm-hmm. I mean, my mom was a park ranger growing up, so I grew up very close to the land, and all of that felt absent in the academic work that I had been presented with. And so the idea to join the Border Patrol was kind of this reaction against that. It was like, well, I feel like I need to be on the ground, see and witness all of these ugly things that are happening. And in my naive, you know, like 21, 22-year-old mind, you know, I had this naive idea that I could, you know, witness these things without participating in them, that I could, you know, just be sort of like a force for good within the agency, and that I would get answers to all these questions and leave and be able to, like, become a policymaker or an immigration lawyer or a diplomat and, you know, have all these answers.
Well, it's interesting. Your mother says to you she was worried that you were going to become part of this system that could be brutal and callous, as she put it. But it's interesting, some of the things that you mentioned. Like, you talk about how that wasn't what you were seeing at the academy, that it wasn't a bunch of that it wasn't people that had this ideology about, you know, guns or law enforcement or about, you know, keeping the border secure, that a lot of it was Latino people who were there just because of stability or opportunity. I mean, in some ways, just kind of there for really ordinary reasons.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that, you know, still hasn't been, you know, fully grappled with by a lot of the existing academic or sociological or journalistic writing about the Border Patrol, because, you know, I think in a lot of and I mean, I should say that, you know, the Border Patrol is, you know, CBP is like the largest law enforcement agency in the nation. Yeah. And so, you know, there's more agents than there are people in the FBI or the DEA. So we are talking about a huge group of people. Yeah. It's a slim majority, but it is, you know, just over the edge of 50% Latino. And I think that what you see is that you see a lot of people who are from border communities. You know, the Border Patrol started recruiting more aggressively outside of the Southwest in the Bush years. And I kind of came on during the tail end of that. So you saw both groups of people, right? You saw people from like Iowa who had never seen a cactus, and then you had people who had like grown up on both sides of the border.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people in these, you know, these kind of more rural border communities, when, you know, as young adults, when they look around and see, you know, who's able to support their family, like who owns their house, who owns a car, who's got benefits. You know, a lot of times they look around and they see that it's people in the military, it's people in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And they're also surrounded by people who are doing that work too. And so it is normalized in a way. But that normalization is also part of what I wanted to interrogate in the book, because along with that, you know, the violence of the institution is normalized as well.
Yeah, which we'll get to, because that's an important part, I think, of the book. It's interesting. It seems like right from the get-go, you start to have these questions about, like, conflicted loyalties and how you felt about this. I mean, there's the story of Robles was one of the trainers, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you write that you wondered if Robles – he tells this story that is – these two stories, actually. One case where he was involved in taking the life of someone, and one completely polar opposite story where he's involved in saving the life of someone. And you write in the book about how you wondered if Robles thought of himself, his body — this was interesting how you put it — if he saw his body as, this is how you put it, a tool for destruction or one of safekeeping. And you wondered about that for yourself. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because it seems like, what am I here for? That seems like a question you were asking yourself then.
Yeah, and I think it's a question that, you know, a lot of people in the Border Patrol and also in different types of law enforcement or military work are sort of presented with and then distracted from. Hmm. And I think that one sort of publicity arm of the Border Patrol is sort of there to tell the public about all of the search and rescue work that they do in the summer. And I think that, you know, that arm of, like, Border Patrol publicity can also be like a recruitment arm. That can be a tool for recruiting people who are like, maybe otherwise on the fence, but they're like, oh, okay, but I could become an EMT. I could be part of this, you know, this like tactical search and rescue team that's going out there and helping people. But of course, it obscures the Border Patrol enforcement practices that are really responsible for pushing people out to the most remote, dangerous corners of the desert, where these kinds of rescues become necessary. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, like, that arm of the Border Patrol is asking for credit, right? They're asking to be recognized for their good work, which is sort of like, you know, firefighters go out and put a blaze in a neighborhood and are asking, you know, to be lauded for that. But it turns out the blaze was started by their own fire chief or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. There's the story you tell early on in the book. You write about, you find this couple in this church and she's pregnant, and the man, in some ways, he's trying to get you to kind of look the other way. Like, don't arrest us. Maybe, he said, drive us back to the border and let us get back into Mexico. We'll go. And he said, you could just take us there and leave us like a brother, he said. What did he mean by that? Was he I guess he was appealing to the fact that you looked like him in some ways, and that I wonder if you felt these kind of conflicted loyalties all the time.
Yeah, I mean, the other half of that story is that his wife was pregnant and had actually grown up in the U.S.
Yeah,
you know, she was.
Wasn't it Iowa?
Iowa.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. She was. She's like a kindergarten teacher in Iowa, who, you know, was undocumented, but had been brought to the U.S. like so many dreamers, right? As a young girl, she spoke fluent English, and so when I first encountered this man, you know, he was like, hey, you know, like, my wife speaks English. You should talk to her. And then so it's kind of like having this bilingual conversation in Spanish with him and then in, you know, completely unstilted English with her. And she,
like, these are the two parts of you in some ways,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And she, you know, was hyper conscious of as they both were, like, what they were doing. And, you know, she had left the country because a family member had become sick. I think her mother, and she had gone to, you know, to care for her, and then, you know, was unable to get back across, but had become pregnant. And she said, you know, I am trying to get back to Iowa because, like, I want my child to have the same life and opportunities and access that I had growing up here. And so I think, you know, as her husband is like watching, you know, this agent who's positioned against them, mm-hmm. you know, move between the two worlds that they are both familiar with navigating. And, you know, he wasn't asking me to let them go or to drive them to, you know, to Phoenix or something like that. He was asking me to just, you know, can we skip the whole being put in a detention room and, you know, getting our fingerprints and our pictures taken and spending, you know, 2 days in jail before we end up back in Mexico. Can we skip all that? You could just take us down to the border and let us go.
You know, I have to say the part that kind of gutted me about that story was the moment when you say there came a moment when you realized you had forgotten their names.
Yeah, and that moment was just an hour or two after the encounter. And I think what was – I mean, at the time, you know, I came home and I like wrote about the encounter, because you would have encounters like these where, you know, you would have this small window where you would be having an encounter or a conversation outside of the assigned roles that you were being given.
Yeah.
But of course, those roles are never really gone, right? You're always at the end of the, you know, like you're wearing the uniform. Mm-hmm. You're part of the system that is designed to keep these people out and send them back. But in a moment like that, when you have this long interaction with somebody and this long conversation, I remember, you know, very specifically asking them for their name and telling them my name, like this introduction, right? Like this common interaction that we have every day, you know, with people. And then, you know, shortly after being like, oh yeah, like I should write down their name before I forget it, and then realizing that it was already gone. And I think looking back on it, I don't know that it was available to me at that time. I mean, obviously I wrote about it and I knew that I didn't have the bandwidth to process all of these encounters, but I knew that I needed to write them down so that I could make sense of it later. Mm. And when I was looking back at that encounter, I was like, man, you know, like right there, that's the first step in dehumanizing someone, right? Yeah. As you forget their name, or their name is unavailable to you.
There's another moment that I wanted to ask you about that was I found to be really powerful. And there's a man you had encountered, and you had arrested him, and it was basically you were waiting to go through the, as you mentioned, that process that you have to go through. And he knows at this point he's going to be returned, but he wants to help out. Like, he's there at this place, and he wants to, like, he's saying, let me take out the trash, or let me sweep the floors, or clean out the cells. And it was this way of saying, look, I'm doing this for a reason. I want to work. Would you talk a little bit about that moment? Because I thought that was a really – it was not a big part of the book, but it was so powerful, I thought.
I mean, I think what's interesting about that moment is that in, you know, like dominant American society, far away, far removed from the borderlands, you know, when you're hearing about the border and about migrants from the news, you hear all these narratives, right? And you know, there's narratives on both sides, right? Like, oh, these are criminals, and then other, you know, the other narrative, like, oh, these are people that are just coming for work. Mm-hmm. But you're very rarely in, you know, I think this is a huge problem with the news media and the way that we've been conceptualizing of this issue for so long in this country, is that, you know, it's so often devoid of, you know, the faces and people and stories of those who are actually crossing, right? And those who are actually being most affected in our communities, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to travel outside of Salt Lake City to see how border issues and border enforcement are playing out. Like, you have people here living in fear. And so to be face to face with a man who's saying, like, look, like, you see me. I'm standing right in front of you. I'm not just going to tell you that I'm here for a job. Put me to work right now. Like, I'll show you. I'll show you in front of your very own eyes. And I think, I mean, it's there to be seen. but people are looking away from it. And I think here was a person who is saying, don't look away from it, or what do I have to do to prove it to you?
Francisco Cantu. His book is The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUVR.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Francisco Cantu, talking about his experience as a Border Patrol agent. His book is The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. There are parts of the book where you sort of look at the history of the border itself, and you write about this Italian priest, Eusebio Kino, you know, explorer and Jesuit missionary in the 1700s, and he's the— You write about the fact that he is, when he's there on the border, or in that area anyway, he's kind of mystified by the people he saw traveling through the desert. And that gave us a sense of how people have always seen the desert as this bad country. Would you talk a little bit about this? Because I thought this was really interesting, how strange it was for people to go to these kind of, you know, austere places and imagine anyone making a life there.
Yeah, and it's built into the language that we use to talk about the desert, because I mean, of course, the language that we've been given is the language of, you know, colonizers, right? And mm-hmm. and in Spanish, the first, you know, the first wave of colonizers that come to the north, the sort of words that they're using to describe this place were words like mal país, yeah. which literally, you know, badlands. We have right. the word in English too,
yeah.
Or despoblado, you know, depopulated. And these words are still attached to how we think about the desert. You know, it's often referred to as like a wasteland or flyover country, or, you know, even the rhetoric of like a frontier or a border positions it as something that is at the edge or at the margins. But of course, for the people that he was encountering, or the people that the colonizers were encountering, were people who, you know, knew how to live with the desert,
yeah.
right? And I think that part of our conception of the desert as a hostile place, you know, the desert itself is not hostile,
yeah.
right? Like this is not an inherently violent place. It's not an inherently hostile place.
Well, if you see the place as hostile or unforbidding, these people were of that place. So how are you going to see the people of that place in the same way, I guess?
Right. And I think, you know, if you and it goes to everything, right? It goes to how we treat the people. It also goes to how we treat the land and the landscape. And of course, you know, here's a perfectly functioning ecosystem that has everything it needs.
Yeah.
And here are a people that have everything they need from the land. And it's only by bringing our outside conceptions of, you know, like building these massive cities and, you know, having water that flows from a tap up from the ground, you know, that is in conflict with that.
I think it's interesting also, and I found this this sort of, I think, gets to the title of your book in a lot of ways. You talk about how the boundary at points, as you put it, gives itself over to the Rio Grande River. And you mentioned how the early surveyors saw the border could change based on the, as you say, the whims of the river. Hmm. Will you talk a little bit about that? Because this is clearly, or at least it seems like, an image that's important to you.
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking about a title for the book, I was thinking about, you know, obviously a lot about duality, but also sort of, I think we have a rigid understanding of what the border is in this country. Hmm. But I think the more the more time you spend trying to understand the border, or if you just grow up with it, you have a very fluid understanding of it. I think when I thought of this title, I was just out on a run and I was imagining the line, the borderline in my mind, just kind of as it moves from the west to the east. And it's this very, you know, sort of like rigid pivoting line, just drawn arbitrarily across the landscape. And then in El Paso, at the where New Mexico and Texas meet, it becomes a squiggling, flowing, twisting, turning thing, even on the map.
Yeah.
And I just think that it's sort of this visual cue for like how we need to move in relation to our understanding of the border. Like this rigid understanding needs to become more fluid.
Well, there's a time early in your experience with the Border Patrol that you say you felt like you were becoming kind of good at it. But then you ask yourself this question, what does it mean to be good at this? And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. Because the question comes up, the things that you're seeing, like the times when agents would, with some intention here, you know, empty water bottles that they encounter or empty backpacks that they find. Because the intention is to get people to come out of their hiding places and to, you know, help them. At least that's the intent. But there's so much conflict here that you seem to be having about that. And you it seems like there were those moments when you wondered, is this in fact good for them? Because you also say there were some of the things that you encountered, some of the things that you saw going on gave you nightmares.
I mean, I think it begs a question, like what you buy when you're caught up in the system and you're part of it is very different than what you buy on the outside looking in. And it's like, you know, is this just sort of callousness and indifference manifest in actions and covered up with like the reverse engineering of an excuse? And I think that, I mean, you know, from the time that you show up at the Border Patrol Academy, it's really not much different from, you know, military basic training, boot camp or any like police academy. These training techniques have been honed through, you know, like centuries really, yeah, to sort of take somebody, break down their idea of who they are as an individual and rebuild them as part of this institution and as part of a core or a fraternity of people. And so, you know, even as somebody who came into it, I thought at the time with a lot of intention, with a lot of, you know, sort of specific questions that I wanted answered. And I wasn't joining for a lot of the reasons that my colleagues were. And that was also my privilege showing, right? I had this academic interest in what I was doing. And it wasn't just because it was the best job I could get with the benefits I needed to support my family. But, you know, as soon as you show up in the field, you're just given so many tasks. Like you have to show up here at this time. Your boots better be polished. Your shirt better be tucked in. And you got to go here, go pick up this person, be back. And all of that is sort of also designed to distract you from like the immediacy of what you're doing. And, you know, you're being told sort of at every turn, directly or indirectly, that the people that you're encountering are criminals or that the encounters that you're preparing for are criminal encounters. And, you know, all of this language, it's like a tooth and a saw that is grinding away at your perception of what you're doing. Because, you know, the truth was that the vast majority of the people that I encountered, you know, were not in a criminal situation. They were in a humanitarian situation.
Right. And in the meantime, you're having dreams and grinding your teeth. At what point did you start to wonder, I'm not sure how long I'm going to be able to do this?
You know, I think the dreams, you know, were very... If we're refusing to grapple with something in our waking life, then it is probably going to manifest itself in our subconscious life.
Yeah.
And I think that another part of that training and another part of like the culture of the Border Patrol, you know, it's this very toxically masculine culture that is, you know, shared by a lot of similar law enforcement military jobs, where there is not a culture of making yourself vulnerable in front of your colleagues and asking them about their doubts or their misgivings about the work that they're involved in. And so, you know, you're not provided with any place where it's okay to talk about that. So it's mostly being relegated to the subconscious, or it's something that you're bottling up and putting away. And, you know, the reason that my mom is such a character in the book is that, she was one of the very few people in my life that was sort of constantly interrogating me and reminding me of like the reasons I had given for wanting to join and are you learning those things and are you are you still after this or are you becoming someone else? Are you having the institution steer you towards its will?
Yeah. It's throughout this the experience there. You're always like, especially when you go through really difficult times or you see really difficult things, you just call your mom at night to say, hey, I'm okay, to check in. It's almost like you're checking in with her in that way too, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because, you know, those people are so important in our lives. And like, I was very blessed to have that persistent mother, but a lot of people don't. And a lot of people, and for example, you know, like my friends that I grew up with in high school and that I remained friends with, you know, throughout the time I was in the Border Patrol, because I was, you know, in Arizona where I had grown up, I was close to these people, I'd hang out with them on the weekend. None of them were ever interrogating me like, hey man, like,
are you staying true to your values?
Yeah. And those were mostly male friends.
Yep.
But I think like part of it is about like how we talk to each other, mm-hmm. As men, but also just as a society. And I think that, you know, for a lot of people who are engaged in that work, like they don't have, they're not really being given the tools to think critically about to what extent that lines up with their values, or to draw the lines between like when this oversteps what I'm willing to see or do or be part of. And that's another question about the book, right? You mentioned people dumping water out and all of these enforcement techniques that like I would see and, you know, I would choose not to participate in them. And I would think that that like saved me, right? Mm-hmm. Or that that exempted me. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're wearing that uniform.
Yeah.
Like you're part of the wheels that are grinding away at these people in the same way. And I think that like that's the question. What is the role of the individual in an institution like that?
What have you done with the critiques that have come? You know, like, look, you're not undocumented. Okay, you have a Latino name. Okay, your mother's Mexican. But should you really be telling these stories? Are you worthy to be telling these stories? Are you benefiting from telling these stories? Because this is somewhat of a critique you've been getting, and you've talked about feeling grateful for it, actually. So would you just talk a little bit about that?
I feel exceedingly grateful for it, and I also feel that those questions, especially in like the publishing landscape, right, where, you know, publishing is still overwhelmingly, you know, like the books that get published and bought and sold are, you know, overwhelmingly by white men. It's like, there was a recent study, and I forget its number, so I shouldn't even bring it up, but it's something like, you know, it's gotten a lot better in the last decade or something, but it's still like, you know, 60% like white men. And, you know, we're still only translating like 3% of literature from other languages and cultures. And I think, you know, when this book came out, you know, I was very privileged to have a mainstream publisher. You know, I had like a publicist dedicated to, you know, promoting this book, getting interviews. And so all of a sudden I'm being presented with this platform and people are like, oh, you know, talk about the border, talk about migrants. And I think people are absolutely right to say like, well, these aren't the people that we really need to be listening to talk about this issue. And so I think part of what we need to grapple with as privileged people is, you know, what is the platform that's being offered to us? Like, why is it being offered to us? And how can we partake in extending that platform? Like, how can we partake in being critical of, you know, what we're receiving for the work that we've done and what other people are not receiving for the same work? Mm. And so, you know, I think about the royalties that this book is going to get. You know, how can I direct some of that money to places that are engaged in like the nitty-gritty complicated work of undoing the things that I was a part of.
Yeah. You write about how Carl Jung had these ideas of symbols. And in he writes about, you mentioned this in the book, he saw the Iron Curtain then as that kind of prevailing symbol of his time, of that time. And he said, and this is, you quote him, he says, it runs through the psyche of modern man. Do you think that the border now? Because we're past the days of the Cold War. We're past the days of thinking about an Iron Curtain, at least in the same way. Is the border today, does that represent this division of our psyche in a similar way, do you think?
I absolutely think it does. And I think that, you know, like with, you know, the Berlin Wall coming down, right, like the Iron Curtain falling was this much celebrated moment. And for good reason, like it felt like a veil was being lifted. But really what has happened is that veil has just broken up and like spread. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's not just our border between the U.S. and Mexico. You know, borders are being militarized all around the world. You know, Mexico's militarizing its border with Guatemala, mm-hmm. with our backing. Yep. You know, Europe is militarizing its borders. That's the deadliest migrant route in the world is yep. across the Mediterranean. And, you know, it's happening in you know, Asia, Africa, Australia. Like, I really think it's not less of a problem. It's more of a preoccupation. And I think, you know, the Jungian idea is that, you know, this bifurcated way of understanding the world, of separating ourselves or walling ourselves off and then othering what is on the other side is really like born in each individual in the psyche. Yep. And it's the same way that, you know, all of the things that I, you know, refused to grapple with in my waking life during the years I was engaged in this violent work were playing out in my subconscious, yeah. right? What Jung would call like the shadow self.
Right.
And I think that that's an apt metaphor because everything that we're doing right now, it has an equal and opposite effect that like we are grappling with, and we're seeing now more people are looking at it now than they have been in the past. But it's not new. Yeah. What's happening at the border? It's not new. Trump's rhetoric, or you know, the way people are being dehumanized on a larger, more obvious, louder scale.
It's interesting as you're feeling these conflicts between your what's going on consciously into your subconscious. You have these recurring dreams. You have these dreams, and you write about them. One where you encounter this wolf who seems, you say, fearsome but also wise at the same time. And later in the book, you're talking about Jung and how he helped you kind of understand it, or at least what you think might be some understanding or explanation for the wolf. Jung said, when you dream of a wolf or something ferocious, like a bear or something like that, it means it wants to come to you. What do you mean? What is that about?
I mean, I think it's about, so Jung has this idea of individuation.
Yeah.
Like that's sort of the object behind Jungian psychotherapy. And you know, the idea is that you can't be a full person until you find a place for that shadow side of yourself and you find a way to hold it at the same time that you hold this other side that's more familiar.
At what point, Francisco, did you realize you couldn't do this anymore?
Yeah, you know, the reason that wolf dream is, you know, prominently placed in the book is because, you know, for me that was really the signal, because in my waking life I felt like I was fine. You know, it was sort of like Jung talks about, you know, sort of like the accumulation of dreams or like a dream series.
Yeah.
And that a lot of times, you know, if you wake up and you're like, well, that was a crazy dream, whatever. you go on about
yeah.
your day.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like the next week you have a like louder, more violent, like more jarring version of that dream. You're like, oh, wow, like it takes a little bit more time to shake that off. And so for me, that dream was that moment where I had been having nightmares and you know, like increasingly violent dreams for a really long time. And that was just the one where I woke up and, you know, like I couldn't get it out of my head. I felt compelled. You know, at the time, it's like I woke up and I'm like Googling, you know, what does it mean when you dream about a wolf? And yeah. like just like looking at all these crappy internet chat rooms.
Right.
But, you know, like that desire to understand, okay, like where was I when I had that dream? What was going on? That was finally the thing that kind of like shook me loose from the work that I was doing, or that like had me pave a path to something else. And, you know, and it was also like that I was grinding my teeth. I remember being at the dentist and they're asking me, they're saying, you know, hey, you grind your teeth. Your teeth look really bad. Are you stressed? Do you have a stressful job? And I'm like, no, I'm fine. Like, my job's fine. Like, and they're like, you know, really? Because you're chipping the enamel off yourself. Because that was a physical manifestation that you couldn't look away from because your dentist is like, well, you need to come back next week and get fitted for a mouth guard and that kind of thing. And so those two things were happening at the same time. And I mean, really talk about just like something, your subconscious finding a way to grab a hold of you and like shake you.
There's this story that you tell about your mother. You know, she grew up being ashamed of being Mexican. And you tell the story about her going to see her father in San Diego. And she had built up this grand image of him. And when she finally meets him, she's kind of disappointed because he just stayed there. He lived a workaday life. And at first she's like, this is so ordinary. Like she's disillusioned completely. But then she comes to a different idea about it. And this question about how being rooted, how staying seemed important is another idea I think that's in the book. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, for my mother, she didn't really grow up close to the Mexican side of the family. Her mother and father split when she was very young, and she grew up with her mother. And it was sort of her mother, you know, her mother was Anglo and, you know, gave her all these ideas of, you know, being ashamed of your Mexicanness or being, you know, pushing aside again, right? Like pushing aside your Mexicanness and minimizing it. And I mean, those are the ideas of the dominant culture, right? That were coursing through her, being passed from society to mother, from mother to daughter.
Yep.
My mom also, you know, as an only child, had really fought and struggled to be this independent woman. You know, in encountering my grandfather, her father, she was also encountering all of these things that had not been available to her as a young woman, which was also like community and family. And like the tradition, you know, the traditions of the Mexican side of the family that she was never included in or part of, you know, like that's a lament that I carry with me too, right? Like I didn't grow up close to my grandfather. I met him a few times when I was a kid, but he had like five brothers and sisters. They all lived in San Diego. They had a Mexican community. They're speaking Spanish with each other, joking. They all lived on like the same street, and so the kids could go out and play in the street and go into the, you know, your tío's house and have dinner over there. And like none of that was available to my mom. You know, she grew up isolated from all that. And I think that, you know, a lot of us that have dual identities, we're often alienated from one side of like ourself and our own history and heritage. And so I think that that's part of grappling with the immigrant experience, is grappling with all the ways that family and dominant culture marginalizes, you know, the richness that is in ourselves.
The last part of the book is this story you tell about Jose Martinez. This is after you leave the Border Patrol, and he's a colleague at first. He works at this coffee shop together, and he's lovely and he's great, and he goes back home to Mexico because his mother is dying. And then he gets arrested coming back. And the way I won't give too much away about the story, but he goes and comes back and goes and gets caught and comes back and again and kind of again and again. And the whole last chapter of the book you basically give to Jose. Kind of in his voice. And he says this, he says, I have to cross. I have to arrive to the other side. I even dream that I am there. I think that the intensity of that draw was something I hadn't really encountered before. Would you talk about that? Because that really made me understand it in a way I hadn't before.
The reason the book turns so sharply towards his story is because, you know, after having, you know, this multitude of encounters with people that were crossing, but just these short exchanges, you know, Jose was somebody that I, you know, had become really close with. And so we are always affected more deeply by something when it plays out in the life of somebody that we know and that we care about. And in Jose's case, I was seeing what would happen to people, you know, once they were apprehended by the Border Patrol, and then after they, you know, once they left the Border Patrol station, like that's not over. You know, we always imagine this encounter in the desert, the front line of the border. Mm-hmm. But there's this vast immigration, incarceration, deportation complex. And Jose had a wife and three kids. All of his kids were born in the U.S. They're U.S. citizens. And so all of a sudden, these kids who'd never crossed a border in their life had had the border thrust into their lives. And this is happening to so many people in this country. That was the first time that I was not only sort of like looking behind the curtain at what would happen to people when they're enmeshed in that system, but also like attempting to guide someone else through it, yeah. You know, because I was familiar with, you know, the enforcement landscape. It was easier for me to figure out, you know, when is he going to court? Where is he being detained? When is visitation? But even for me as like an English speaker, you know, he was being obscured, where he was, yeah. When you could see him. Could you see him? Mm-hmm. Could his wife, who didn't have documents, could she come into the courtroom? Could yeah. she come to see?
Could they, you know, talk to each other?
Right.
Yeah.
And she couldn't. Yeah. I mean, she could go into the courtroom. She could not go into prison visitation. And you know, I think what really affected me was hearing him explain, look, like, I understand the laws of the United States. And the rule of law in the United States is what makes me want to live there and not somewhere else. And that's what makes me want to raise my children there. But at the same time, this law that would have me separated from them is, you know, he explained it that his family values supersede that law. And so I think he almost saw it as like an act of civil disobedience. And I think what his case just so, you know, obviously shows us is what's there to be seen all the time if we choose to look at it, that, yeah. You know, no matter what version of hell we implement at the border through our enforcement policies, people are going to endure that to get to the other side, no matter what it is. And I think that, you know, then the question becomes, do we spend all of our time and resource and political capital to make it a hellscape where people are going to lose their lives in greater and greater numbers because that's what's happening? Or, you know, do we attempt to really take a long, hard look at it and do the politically and socially difficult task of reforming the system or, you know, breaking down and reimagining what the border means?
Is this kind of beautiful image that you offer right at the end of the book? I wanted to maybe, if you didn't mind, saying something about you're standing in the river. In the shallow part of the river, and for a minute you forget in which country you're standing.
That was several years after I had left the Border Patrol and, you know, was really involved in trying to distance myself from that life and that identity in every way. And for somebody who had done that work in Arizona, I mean, the border looks differently all along the line, right? Yeah. It looks different in Nogales than it does in San Diego. It looks different in at the end of the pedestrian fence in the mountains than it does, you know, 4 miles closer to town. But to be, you know, this was in Big Bend National Park, mm-hmm. You know, really like the most remote corner of the border, so remote that there's no wall, there's no fence, there's no patrols. You know, there's like, I mean, I don't know what it's like now, but at this time there, you know, I didn't see a Border Patrol agent the entire time I was in Big Bend National Park and the whole park's on the border. And so, you know, to stand, to like be in the river that is the border and to like see people riding across it on horseback and, you know, crossing over to sell you, you know, tourist trinkets was just such a window into, you know, what the place really is. It's a landscape just like any other, right? Like these are canyons and rivers and mountains and people. And that was really beautiful.
Francisco Cantu, His book is The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. He joined us recently when he was in Utah for a book reading. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.